My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, I'm Georgia and welcome back to my channel for another episode in my mystery series, where today I want to talk to you about a case that desperately needs more exposure, the tragic death of David Elmquist. Officials signed this off as suicide, but after reviewing the police reports and the autopsy, it became clear to David's family that there was a lot more going on here. They're currently working to spread the word. They need signatures on their petition to get an outside independent prosecutor appointed to review David's death. Today, I'm going to share David's story, and I'm not here to make any accusations or say exactly what happened in this case. The point is that nobody knows what happened because this case was not investigated properly and it needs to be looked at again so true justice can be served. The petition will be linked down below, so for any point in the story you think that this does need to be looked into again, I implore you to go and sign it, be an active listener of true crime. We do what we do here to try and help in any way we can, and your signature in this case really could make all the difference. I want to start by telling you a bit about David Scott Elmquist. He was born February 24th, 1993 in Buffalo, Minnesota and grew up in rural Kokato, attending Dassel Kokato High School before graduating in 2011. He then went on to further education at the Association Free Lutheran Bible School in Plymouth, a very conservative Christian college, but he never actually ended up graduating. Eventually, he went to work in North Dakota in the Bakken oil fields alongside his older brother Eric, and he loved the oil fields. He called it God's country and was surrounded by this loving brotherhood. He was in his early 20s and was earning a six-figure salary in a job he loved, but eventually moved back home to Minnesota to get married in 2017, settling in Plymouth. We'll refer to his wife as Miss X throughout this video to preserve her anonymity. Once back in Minnesota, he got a job working on a water well, doing digging, treatment and maintenance. David has been described as kind-hearted, generous, hilarious, the life of the party, God-loving and incredibly hard-working. He loved to spend time with his family over the holidays and particularly loved spending time with his nieces and nephews. He loved to ski and had qualified for the Junior Olympics in slalom downhill skiing as a kid, being coached by his dad. He also loved to play golf, play on his Xbox, and supported the Vikings, his American football team. Although David had only recently moved back to Minnesota, he wanted to move back to North Dakota again to work on oil fields. As I said before, he loved his job out there. He told his dad, Scott, shortly before his death, that he just wanted to live a quiet life and work hard. In 2018, a series of events would happen that would eventually lead to David's tragic death. He was 24 years old at this point and had been married for 11 months. He was deeply unhappy with where his life had ended up. David and Miss X had met many years earlier as their families both attended the same church. David always had a crush on her and they did go to prom together in high school, but nothing serious ever really came of their relationship until they were adults and reconnected. They eventually got engaged and did end up having to delay their wedding by a number of months due to David working on the oil field. Him and Miss X lived in North Dakota together, but she eventually decided that they should move back to Minnesota, so that's what they did, leading to David quitting the job he loved. On the afternoon of his death, the 9th of February 2018, exactly 4 years ago today, if you're watching this on the day I'm uploading it, David went to visit his family and complained about his toxic marriage. He said that his wife was manipulative and was trying to cut him off from his family, and he wanted a divorce. Only because David had grown up in such a religious community, he was concerned about how him getting a divorce would affect his parents in the church. After a conversation with his parents where they said that all they wanted was for him to be happy, he said that he was planning to leave her. He was going to tell his wife that night and was going to move back home the very next day. When asked what he thought his wife was going to say, David said that she'd go ballistic. But I don't think this in itself really raised any alarms. A lot of people probably wouldn't welcome a divorce with open arms. But just 8 hours later, David was dead by what the authorities would declare as a suicide by self-immolation. He'd set himself on fire. As you can imagine, this is one of the rarest forms of suicide, so much so that I couldn't really find any solid statistics about it in my research. Self-immolation as suicide is mostly used to make public political statements. It's a way to ensure that your death gets reported by the media. It's a choice made by martyrs, often an altruistic suicide. The sacrifice of one's life to bring attention to a cause. Self-immolation in cases like David's are very, very rare, which immediately raises some questions. Why would he have made this choice? In the days immediately following his death, David's family were obviously overcome with grief, but Scott called the police the very next day to share with them what David had told him about his marriage, his wife, and his plans to move back home. Now, it's very important to note in this case that David had recently had some issues with his mental health, and as Scott, his father, has said in an Instagram post on their page, Truth for David Scott, it's very easy for people to discount any other possibility of how David died other than suicide, when all they know is that David was suffering from mental health issues. The fact that he was suffering with his mental health in the weeks before his death does make it easy to discount his case as suicide without raising many questions, but this doesn't mean that a full investigation isn't necessary. As they say, if no one has done anything wrong, no one has anything to fear. But as you'll come to see throughout this video, there are many questions that need answering, and that's all the family are trying to get, answers. This story really begins on January 20th, 2018, just under 3 weeks before his death. Scott received a strange text from David. It was incredibly unusual behaviour for him, so his parents go to visit him at his apartment to find out if he was okay and what was going on. Not knowing what was going on, they did the only thing they could think of and they took a drug testing kit with them, thinking that maybe that could provide an answer as to David's really weird behaviour. Once they arrived, they asked David if they could do the drug test, to which David agreed and then stripped naked in the living room in full view of everyone. David, 6'2" and 190 pounds, ended up naked on his hands and knees on the living room floor, clearly in a very unwell mental state. His wife, Miss X, got down in front of him and started aggressively slapping him in the face, shouting his name. As his parents shouted at her, asking what she was doing, she replied that this had worked before. In later questioning, Miss X would admit that this had happened, that she had been slapping David, that when he got in this state, she would smack him in the face, grab his head and say, "Look at me." Miss X is a petite woman, 5 foot tall to David's 6 foot 2. David was undoubtedly in a very vulnerable position that night and according to Miss X, had been before, and his father states that despite his mental state, David was never violent or suicidal. He was actually in the kind of state where he would have done anything he was ordered to do. If Scott had told him to jump out of the window that night, he probably would have done it without even thinking. The later autopsy would state that at the time of his death, David was not under the influence of drugs or alcohol, but was suffering from a severe case of psychosis with delusions, extreme paranoia, and possible hallucinations. He would have been completely defenseless whilst in this state. The word psychosis is used to describe conditions that affect the mind, in which people have trouble distinguishing between what is real and what is not, often referred to as a psychotic episode. As you can imagine, it's a very frightening and distressing experience, particularly the first time it happens to you. But psychosis is treatable. Many people never have a reoccurring episode after their first. That night, Scott ended up driving David to the hospital, and they eventually got referred to the Fairview Mental Health Hospital. Once there, he got prescribed an antipsychotic drug and ended up spending 10 days there to get himself healthy again. The drugs did do their job and David got back into a better headspace, but it is worth noting that about 3 days before his death, he did stop taking the drugs. I feel like it's relevant to the story to mention that David did grow up in a very religious Christian community, and as an adult, he started to drink and smoke weed. I'm not talking to a concerning level or to a level of dependency, but in the community David grew up in, even the occasional beer or joint was something that would raise eyebrows. Scott has found that along with the mental health issues David had, his alcohol and drug usage has also caused people to write off his case as an obvious suicide. As you've already heard, drugs or alcohol were not a contributing factor in his death. But some do question whether David's weed usage could have been a cause of the psychosis that he suffered or perhaps worsened it. But we don't know anything for sure. It could be that psychosis was always going to rear its head around this age regardless of any drugs. A quick Google showed me that psychosis usually first appears in a person's late teens, early 20s, and approximately 3 out of 100 people will experience an episode of psychosis in their lifetime. So it could well be that David was always going to struggle with this. Importantly, David had no drugs or alcohol in his system at the time of his death. Evidence of weed can be found in your system for up to 30 days after you last smoked, and the last time it's known that David smoked was 3 days before his psychosis episode. So we can assume that this was the last time he smoked, almost 30 days before his death, meaning that there was no more trace in his system. It's important for us to note that, just in case anyone thinks drugs or alcohol could have been a contributing factor here, they weren't. They did not cause his death, and I wouldn't characterise his use of alcohol or drugs in this case as a substance problem, he just did them occasionally. So then we come to the night of David's death, February 8th, 2018. Immediately following on from what I've just shared about David's diagnosis of psychosis and generally poor mental health, I don't blame you if you hear what I'm about to say and accept it as suicide. But David's family had a lot of unanswered questions at the time of his death, and they were never really given any answers as to what happened. It wasn't until they received the police report 31 months after David's death that they really started to question the investigator's narrative, as it revealed that the apartment door had never been locked that night, and you'll come to see why that was an important point later in the video. As I mentioned at the beginning of this, all David's family are asking for is for an independent prosecutor to be appointed to the case so it can be looked into with no bias, so they can rest finally knowing what happened that night. Because there are undeniably some things that just do not add up here. If official reports are to be believed, David woke up his wife late on the 8th of February dripping with oil. He kept several Gatorade bottles filled with oil in his apartment, as well as a jug of unrefined bacon oil from his days working in the oil fields, and he'd reportedly poured all this over his head. Miss X said that he pushed her out of the apartment, locked the door, and set himself on fire. She said all of this happened within a matter of seconds. She didn't have time to react, and as she walked down the corridor and looked back, she saw a wisp of smoke coming under the door. Although she said that all of this happened in a matter of seconds, being woken up and pushed out the door, she still managed to leave with the keys to her truck, her phone, and the couple's dog. The timing here raises some questions for David's family. How quickly was he able to set himself on fire at this point? So much so that smoke was already making its way under the door. Miss X would later say that David had a lighter in his hand as he pushed her out the apartment. But strangely, this lighter has never been found by investigators, not a single remnant of it. Even if it had been burned, you'd find evidence of the melted plastic, but it seems to have disappeared. When Scott raised this point to the investigators, they said that maybe David had thrown it out of the window after he'd set himself on fire. Why would he do that? And even if that was the case, the lighter wasn't found outside the apartment building either. Miss X was interviewed 6 months later and she was asked what happened to the missing lighter, to which she responds, "Oh, my mum found it over by the kitchen table, which was a pretty far distance, and moved it onto a counter that was closer, I think, to the stove." Supposedly, this happened a week after the fire whilst they were cleaning the apartment out. And if that's the case, how did the police not find it? Either somebody is lying here, or no proper investigation was ever conducted at the crime scene. Despite Miss X's mother being the one to allegedly find this lighter, she's never been interviewed. On the night of the fire, at 10:59pm, 911 receives a call from David's neighbour, and that would be the first 911 call they would receive about this incident. The neighbour is panicking, saying there's a fire in the apartment complex, and gives the door number of David's apartment. The dispatcher asks her if everyone's out of the apartment, to which the neighbour says she doesn't know, but she does say there was a woman, Miss X, running around screaming, and there was a lot of smoke. The neighbour's partner goes out to Miss X in the hallway, who's screaming about David starting a fire, and asks her what she's doing. Why hasn't she called 911, even though her phone is in her hand? 1 minute later, Miss X calls 911 herself, saying her husband has started a fire. She replies saying that she'd seen just a whiff of smoke when asked if he'd already started the fire. But the neighbour said there was a lot of smoke at this point, a terrible fire, and that was just 1 minute before. By this point, the fire alarms in the building were likely already blaring. The first person to arrive on the scene after David was already on fire was a maintenance worker with the apartment building, who heard the fire alarm and runs into the apartment. The fire was very localised around the dishwasher and the sink, and he puts out the fire in the kitchen with a fire extinguisher. But police reports would later say that he didn't see David at any point. However, there was fire extinguisher dust found on David in the autopsy. He'd been put out by the extinguisher. The maintenance worker was interviewed and he stated that he put out the small fire in the kitchen and then saw David on fire and extinguished him. So why does the police report say that no one saw David? The maintenance worker also, very importantly, said nothing of David being armed and dangerous. Police arrived a few minutes after this and made some very strange choices. Choices which could be the reason why so many things seemed to be questionable in the later investigation. They propped open the door of David's apartment and placed two police officers on each side of the door. At the same time, they set up a command centre in the apartment opposite David's and then started calling for David to come out. At no point did they enter the apartment to administer aid. By this point, the fire had already been put out. It seems that the police had been told by Miss X that David had knives on him, which led them to believe that he would attack them if they entered the apartment. They wouldn't even allow fire and rescue inside either, with the fire marshal later saying that they'd been told by the police that David was inside, lying in wait. The later final police report says nothing of this, instead saying, due to the fact that David had purposely lit himself on fire and was not acting rationally, it would not have been even prudent or safe to allow firefighters to enter the dwelling. The police chief would later say that it was firefighters who rescued David, who was suffering from smoke inhalation and severe burns, but this was also not true. 39 minutes after the first 911 call was made, David stumbled out of the apartment before immediately collapsing. For 39 minutes, he'd been inside the apartment fighting for his life. He only left the apartment when police decided to shoot out the windows to release the smoke, and I can't imagine the strength it would have taken him to be able to get out of there. There's evidence in the bedroom, literally pieces of skin, to suggest that he'd gone in there and laid on the bed after he'd been burned. After walking out of the apartment before collapsing, there are contrasting statements about what happened. One police report states that David asked for a drink of water. Other police statements make no mention of this, even one going as far as to say David tried to speak but was unable. He collapsed after this and David was taken to hospital where he was put on a ventilator. As David was married, it was ultimately his wife's decision to take him off the ventilator in the early hours of February 9th. As you can imagine, David's parents were in such a state that they had to leave the hospital before his official death, something which they say haunts them to this day. They've told me that they wish the doctor would have done a timeout so they could have come back the next day. But because the doctors believe that this was a case of suicide, they wanted to help David pass quickly. He should have died surrounded by friends and family. Instead, he died alone with the nurse and chaplain just a few minutes after being taken off the ventilator at 2:46 a.m. After David's death, an autopsy took place, and awfully, David's family have had to repeatedly view their own child's autopsy photos and autopsy report over the last few years in their attempts to make sense of what happened that night. What I'm about to share of the state of David's body is particularly hard to hear, so if you'd rather not know the details, I recommend skipping forward about 30 seconds. David had been burned on over 90% of his body, the right side more burned than the left. His hands had been partially degloved, meaning the skin had literally come off. He had inhalation burns in and around his mouth, and his eyelids had been inverted, rendering him blind. That makes the fact that the police forced him out of the apartment before they administered medical help even harder to hear. Not only would the thick smoke have made it hard for him to see, he had literally been blinded. The forensic pathologist who looked at David for the autopsy made no mention of the fact that there were these distinct, untouched areas on the inside of both of his wrists. That was something that Scott noticed himself when later viewing the photos. And this is incredibly important. Why were the insides of both of his wrists the only parts of his body unaffected by the flames? It's almost as if there's a straight line across his wrist going from burned to protected. I'm going to include a photo here so you guys can see what I'm trying to describe. Again, if you're more sensitive or just don't want to see it, then skip forward about 15 seconds or just close your eyes. But essentially, David had two patches on the inside of each of his wrists that were just regular skin, unburned, untouched, clean. How? The rest of his body was so burned and the events of that evening were so horrific that even some of the fire workers who see things like this day in, day out, had to take time off. Speaking of the patches on his wrists, I think most people's minds would jump to the fact that David could have been wearing gloves, but he wasn't. They found no remnants of gloves and that wouldn't have only protected the inside of his wrists. After Scott called an independent fire investigator to analyse the crime scene, it was found that the likelihood is that as David was set on fire, his wrists were resting on the edge of the kitchen sink. There was oil running down the cabinets below the sink and an inconsistent spill pattern on the edge of the countertop, as if there was something protecting it from the oil. The fire investigator would say, "It appears that within a reasonable degree of certainty that this is consistent with a protected area, as if his arms were resting on the sink edge at or near the time of ignition of the fire. The width of the sink and counter edge in the photographs are similar with the markings on the anterior arm. Based upon review of the fire damage and the autopsy report and photographs, it is my opinion that Mr. Elmquist was the item that was on fire within that space." The fire itself was very localised to a small area in the kitchen by the sink and the dishwasher. Just a really quick side note before I continue with the story. Next door are currently doing renovations on the house and have been since they moved in. So if you hear hammering and banging and drilling, that's that. I'm trying to like work around it, but I've been filming for like 2.5 hours now and I'm about to lose it. Also, I've got a kitten who keeps meowing and demanding attention. So if you see something, I think you can see her ears in the corner there. There you go. And there's the drilling. I'm having a nightmare, but we're on like a time constraint to get this video up. So sorry if it's not great quality audio. I don't know, it's echoey in here. I'm sorry. Moving house, it's been a stress. Getting a kitten, it's been a stress. It's fine. Perhaps the most interesting thing about the protected parts of David's wrist is the position this means he must have been in at the time of ignition. If he was leaning forward over the sink, wrists resting on the edges, how was he supposed to have set himself on fire? If we're following Miss X's story, he was already covered with oil at this point. He would have been engulfed by flames almost immediately. But also, there's no oil on the clean spots on his wrist, or even below where his wrists were rested on the edge of the sink, suggesting that the oil was poured over him whilst he was in that resting position. But how can he do that himself if both his wrists are down? And then how was he supposed to have used a lighter to set himself on fire and then apparently throw the lighter out the window as suggested by the police department? Not only was this part of the body not burned, it was also completely clean. There was no oil on the underside of his wrist, which is easy to tell as bacon oil is brown. If he'd poured the oil over his own head, how would these two parts of his body just remain entirely clean? And we all know it's not easy to remove oil. This raised some huge questions, and it soon became clear that this wasn't the only odd thing about the case. Next, we'll talk about a mysterious knife seen in the crime scene photos, lying on the floor near where David was sitting, as well as a knife sharpener also found nearby. This knife was completely clean, it had no flesh, debris, or bodily fluids on the blade or on the handle. And this was confirmed by the lead crime scene investigator, who said there were two kitchen knives found lying on the dining room floor. I examined the knives along with Hennepin County Crime Labs and determined that neither had any evidence of bodily fluids on them and neither appeared to have played a role in this incident. Shouldn't this have immediately raised some questions? In one of the crime scene photos, you can see the knife block from which the knife and sharpener would have been taken. Instead of being covered in smoke and soot, as you would expect, there's instead a void pattern in the knife block, which looks to be where the knife sharpener had been. This indicates the sharpener was in place next to the knife block at the time of the fire, and all the soot was falling around it. This sharpener was removed after the soot had settled and then it was moved to the floor. It wouldn't have been David who did that. But why is this important? Why is it important that there was a knife at the scene? As we've previously covered, the police have said that they didn't enter the apartment to provide aid to David that night because they had been warned by Miss X that David had a knife on him. The only witness to what happened in the moments before the fire is Miss X. And David had likely just told her that he wanted a divorce. David's family believed that the knife was planted by the Plymouth Police Department to make it look like David was a threat to the officers, justifying the fact that they did not let fire and rescue in to save his life. It's thought that because the police messed up so much in their response to the situation, and they realised so quite quickly, they immediately created a false narrative and planted the knife. The Plymouth police were the only people who had access to the apartment immediately after the fire. And they noted in their report that the officers attending the scene could not see into the apartment and had no communication whatsoever with David whilst he was in there. Apart from Miss X's word, they had nothing to back up their assumption that David was acting irrationally. The family didn't receive the police reports till 31 months after David's death, in which it said that the knife played no role in the events of that night. It was only at this point that they realised the extent of this cover-up. David's family think that instead of the Plymouth police just admitting their error, they planted the knife and have been protected by the blue wall of silence ever since. Cover-ups, collusion, conspiracies, planting evidence and obstruction. They want the Minnesota Attorney General to appoint an independent prosecutor to thoroughly investigate David's case, Miss X, and the Plymouth Police Department. They have no interest in accusing anyone of anything, they just want a solid, unbiased investigation conducted. Something else in the police report that raised questions was the fact that the door to David's apartment was never locked that night. If the door was locked behind David, that would point towards suicide. He locked himself in and set himself on fire. The lead investigator and Hennepin County senior attorney would later parrot the same information back to Scott that the door was locked. Only the maintenance worker who was first on the scene, who put out the fire, said that the door to David's apartment was never locked that night. He opened it right up and walked in. However, Miss X has said that David pushed her out of the apartment and locked the door behind her so she couldn't get back in when she tried. The fire then reportedly started almost immediately, so it's not like he went back and unlocked the door again. There is nothing about the door being locked in any of the police reports. In fact, it makes references to it being unlocked 11 different times. If the door wasn't locked, why have so many people said it was? To protect themselves. As is written on the change.org page, on the night of David's death, the police took photos of David's recent hospital records. To them, this was simply a crazy man who lit himself on fire, and in that moment, David lost any chance of a fair and honest investigation. Mental health discrimination played a huge part in the dismissal of David's case and made it easy for the investigators. Nobody was going to question them on this, and for a while, nobody did. There's no denying that David was suffering with some mental health issues at the time of his death, but that doesn't change the fact there are undeniably things about this case that just do not add up. I hope I provided everything you need in this video to make you understand why this case needs to be reopened, why it needs to be looked at again. There's clear evidence that someone has tried to cover things up. There's things that just don't make sense. What are they trying to cover up? If you do want an over 2-hour deep dive into this case, I would highly recommend you go and listen to the podcast True Crime Exposed, who have nearly 2.5 hours worth of episodes on this case, in which the host interviews Scott about this case in incredible depth. Scott has also filmed his own YouTube video in which he outlines all the main points in this case, which again is definitely worth a watch. This is a family who are desperate for answers, who just want justice for their son and are working so hard to get it. There's also the Instagram page at Truth for David Scott, which I would highly recommend going to follow. They're constantly updating it with new information, new things that just don't make sense. There seems to be a never-ending supply of things in this case that just do not make sense. This is a family who are desperate for answers, who just want justice for their son and are working so hard to get it. Also, please make sure you go and check out the change.org petition. Of course, I'll also leave the link for that down below. When you sign a petition on change.org, you've got to put in your details, then they'll send you an email. You've then got to click on the link in the email, otherwise your signature just doesn't count. So please, if you're doing it, make sure you do it properly. Of course, the very end of this video, the kittens finally decided to go quiet and the builders have also stopped as well, which is just sod's law. I've literally been trying to do this for over 3 hours now. And just because I always get shouted at in videos when I mention a cat and don't show it, this is our kitten Crumble. We've had her for a week today and she's not a big fan of being picked up yet, but we're working on it. Okay, darling. Okay, you go. Okay. She's very, very cute. Thank you so much for tuning in this week and I will see you in the next one. Bye, guys.